thatgreatbusinessshow.com is brought to you by DeFacto Shaving Oil, the best anyone can get. Made in Ireland, sold worldwide.
Welcome to episode 68 of That Great Business Show, posting on the 31st of December, 2021. I'm Conal O'Moran, and today I'm having an extended chat with a one-time farmer turned robotics expert who also happens to be the CEO of Deloitte in Ireland. Harry Goddard has been the big boss at Deloitte since 2019. Prior to that, he had been head of consulting, having joined from another consultancy firm, Bearing Point. In other words, Harry has never been an accountant, and that means that for the next hour, we can avoid audits, auditing, and auditors completely. Hey, hey! But he does have an awful lot to say about an awful lot of business issues. So let's get to it. Harry Goddard, welcome to That Great Business Show.
Very happy to be here, Colin. Thank you very much.
I called you a farmer. Why?
I grew up in the west of Ireland, in County Clare. And we had a small amount of land, but straight across the road, there was this enormous hundreds of acres of farm, which I worked on. So I spent my summers and weekends working hard. And every season, hay, cattle, sheep, everything throughout the year. I really, really loved it. And I remember, in particular, my dad at the time was working in Ennis. We lived in Newmarket and Fergus. And it was, I went to school, in secondary school, in Flannans in Ennis. And I remember my dad driving me in one morning, leaving cert year. So it was a stressful time. And he turned to me in the car and he was saying, you know, you really need to get down to your studies because it's important that you get the chance to go to university. To which I casually replied, if I get there, I get there. And if I don't, I can continue to work on the farm. He nearly crashed the car, the poor man. And I, having kids that age now today, I can relate to his experience. But that is that was where I started, I suppose.
So you gave up a good farming background and you went into UL where you studied applied maths. And then you just kept on at it.
I was very lucky in secondary school. I had a maths teacher who was the sort of person that cared less about your ability and more about your potential. And certainly my maths teacher saw lots of potential, even if my exams didn't evidence there being any real ability, and gave me a huge amount of encouragement. And that inspired a real love of the subject within me. And I decided to go and pursue a career in maths. And I was always a practical person from the farming background, I guess, and decided that therefore applied maths was the appropriate subject, which they did in Limerick. And of course, Limerick at the time was probably unique, perhaps with DCU, in that they offered work experience through your four-year course. So that
it's a great place still. And they had very, very innovative ideas, such as didn't they have a trading floor? Maybe they still have a trading floor. And I've done some work down there. Really, really nice place. Lovely campus as well.
Great campus. And I might just, part of my petition, Conal, is that a lot of the University of Limerick is now, in fact, in Clare.
So it's divided by the river, isn't that it? And if you cross the river, would that be right?
That's exactly it. You're in Clare.
You see, I did do my homework.
Indeed.
Now, out of UL, you come and then go to?
I joined a very small software development company. While I was studying maths, I did my work experience. I ended up working in an insurance company where I discovered technology and software development. And that became my passion, I suppose. So I graduated. I worked in a small software development company. There was about six people in the company. We were in a house on Adelaide Road, one of the Edwardian
in Dublin,
terraced houses. Yes, in Dublin. Yep. There was about four different companies, I think, in this particular house. And I was based in the converted attic.
You were working there, not living there?
Working there.
Yeah, okay.
Indeed. Yeah. So there was about four companies in this house. And this company for whom I worked had about six employees. As I say, I was based in the attic, surrounded by computers that I was working on, which generated huge amounts of heat.
Oh, geez.
And okay. Of course, the Velux window could only be opened on the dry days. So it was a good experience, very developmental.
A sauna.
A veritable sauna, indeed.
And you haven't got a pick on you yet. So out of there, I can see that I was surprised in one way that farmers very free, well, they are by their nature, they're entrepreneurs. You had working with a small tech company, but there's no sign, I'm not hearing that you wanted to go off and become a tech entrepreneur or similar.
No, I suppose that was never really in my, I mean, I wouldn't say I ever had a big plan. And I lived a little bit by the adage, perhaps naively at that stage, that I was, you know, I would do what I enjoy and I would continue to ensure that I enjoyed what I was doing. When I started working in that company, I was very technically orientated. I was doing software development. I really enjoyed the engineering challenges that that created. And at one point, the owners of this company decided to unleash me on their customers. And I went over to the UK to meet with the end clients. And in that experience, my responsibility was to speak to them and really understand how technology could make a difference in their work. And I loved that.
Okay, I can see where that goes.
Really loved that. And that took me out of the product development side of technology and really into working with clients.
So we'll skip forward because you went to Bearing Point, then you went into Deloitte and you moved up the head of consultancy and now BossBoss since 2019. You are in charge of 3,000 people. That is a lot by any stretch.
It's a huge number. And before I get down to the 3,000, there's over 100 partners in the firm.
Just literally, and I've often wondered this, do you physically meet? I forget about COVID now, but yeah. During non-COVID times, do you all get into a room or a very, very large room and have a partners meeting?
Indeed, three times a year.
But you're 100 partners, and I've been a partner in a stockbroking firm. We had 10. I mean, if 10 people speak for 5 minutes each, that's an hour gone. Yeah. 100 partners, sure, that's days, weeks, years.
It's about what you want from the meeting. And I think the partners are really confident that that the purpose of the meetings is the opportunity for them to connect, to collaborate. We will have done the work outside of the room in relation to our strategy. We will provide the information about the performance of the business outside of the room. So it's less about giving every partner the opportunity to speak, but giving every partner the opportunity to engage in our strategy and plans.
Now, I know you're not going to really answer this, but cynical old me, those partners who want to make their mark, young people, men, women coming through, they're going to put up their hands and they'll want to talk to make sure that you know that they exist. Now, take 20 people of 10 minutes each. How long do the partner meetings last?
We ran a national partner meeting, which was going to be in person on Friday, which we moved to virtual, and we did it over 3 2-hour slots on Thursday and Friday. And it was a very successful meeting.
So 6 hours.
6 hours, started and ended on time. We had a series of external speakers as well as internal speakers. Very positive. The model of engagement, though, I think around the partnership has evolved quite a bit. And for us, for example, we transitioned from the Irish partners owning the Irish Deloitte business to becoming part of Deloitte North South Europe. So we're part of a much larger entity. And while we're part of a much bigger organization, which has hundreds of partners in it, we have far less influence within it. So actually, what that takes away is the need for us to get really involved in the day-to-day operations of the business, and it gives us the space to focus on the strategy for the business, because that's ultimately where we can make the greatest impact.
I have in the past belonged to a very, very large organization, ABN AMRO Bank. One time, I think it was 8th or 9th largest bank in Europe. One thing I did notice during my years working there is cross-border businesses find it very difficult to actually really do business. You've got a pal, say in London, and he is not in Deloitte. It's very easy to pick up the phone to him or her and do business with them. But to find and to actually do business within a firm is not the same, is it?
I think we have evolved again quite significantly. Very practical things, the technology platforms that we have in place. We've got a single collaboration platform worldwide for our 330,000 people.
330,000 in the practice?
Worldwide.
Oh, well,
in the business.
Well,
yeah, indeed,
there's
yeah.
only 330,000 people on this island. That's an enormous number.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So we use a series of tools, whether it's Teams or Zoom, to facilitate connectivity. We've got platforms for sharing information. We've got single systems that support the work that we do with our clients. Technology is a very significant part of how we both collaborate and serve the marketplace. And in terms of us coming together and being a more globally connected organization, the real driver behind that is that our clients are global. So if I think about the large clients that we're dealing with, whether they're privately owned Irish businesses or global entities, they are all operating across borders. They all require support across borders. They need the access to expertise in different marketplaces. So it's fundamental to us to be able to provide that to them.
How do you pitch for business?
There tends to be a couple of things, and it starts with how well the organization and we know each other.
Okay, fresh business. The hard stuff.
The hard stuff, which is fresh.
Have you ever made a cold call?
Absolutely. Many, 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 many cold calls in my time.
Do you hate them or do you love them?
You get to the point, I think, Conal, where they just become part of the job. And I don't know many people that leap out of bed in the morning thinking, I can't wait to do those 10 cold calls today.
I was definitely not one of them, exactly. Yeah.
But they're just a feature of the business. And when I you know, at a very practical level, when I joined Deloitte 13 years ago, and at that stage I joined to establish a technology consulting business, Deloitte didn't have a reputation for technology consulting. And you're therefore ringing organizations and partners in the firm, by the way, to explain to them what it is that we do and how we can serve them.
And that has been built to 750 people now. That's not bad.
It's a significant part of the business now, yeah.
Because, and there is obviously a lot of talk about this, eventually large organizations like your own will break away from audit and they'll become different organizations. Let me put it that way.
Our business is over 175 years old. And in that time frame, the range of services that we provide, the requirements that our clients have changed really, really significantly. And as a result of that, we have seen a real increase in the level of regulatory oversight that we experience, which I think is appropriate for our business. But what that regulatory oversight does is it wants to create a perimeter between the business that we have that serves the capital markets, which is the regulated audit business, and the other services that we provide to the marketplace, which ultimately came from that innate capability we had in the first instance. In the UK, we've seen the regulator move to establish what's called operational separation, so a ring fencing of the audit business. We haven't seen that in other geographies. There have been other tools that have been used, for example, in the US, where they use Sarbanes-Oxley as the mechanism to provide stronger oversight to the audit market as opposed to trying to separate and break up the firms. Bearing Point, which you referenced, in 2001 separated from KPMG Consulting, which was du jour at that time to spin these businesses off.
Well, one remembers Arthur Anderson and Anderson. Where are they now?
Indeed, and we're on the 20th anniversary of Enron.
Are we? Oh, wow. Okay.
This year, indeed.
Yeah, I remember that. So are you telling me that you're therefore not going to split out the audit?
We have no strategic intent to split the audit business out from the rest of the firm. We see that there's a lot of value, in particular, there's a lot of value in the audit. As audits become more complex, as businesses become more complex, getting access to the capabilities in other parts of our business is incredibly important.
But there is always conflict.
There will be conflicts. I mean, If I look at the size of our business worldwide and the market share that we have, it is relative to the size of the market, it's in small percentage numbers. There are going to be conflicts. There are clients that we can't work with for either ethical or financial conflict, moral reasons.
I was actually thinking more internal conflict, the famous Chinese walls.
And that's gotten much stronger, Conal. So we have internally very strong systems around conflict management, which ensure that we are serving the right clients with the right sets of services in the right way with the right team. And we've seen evidence in the professional services marketplace outside of the big four market where conflicts can create real challenges for those firms in how they serve clients. So that's a discipline that we have had that I think is a real differentiator for us. And it's not something that we see as a significant obstacle to us doing business and growing the firm in the future.
Isn't it funny? And I said we won't be talking about auditing. Oh, Jesus, we've slipped into it already. One of the areas that you specialize in, and I mentioned it at the intro, robotics. You are literally, and when I say you, Deloitte is literally changing the way government is done here.
The government established a framework agreement a number of years ago to seek a single vendor to provide support in the learning, development and implementation of robotics, robotic process automation technology. And Deloitte are the firm that are their partner in that regard. And that has been a really, really successful initiative for both parties.
And I've seen some of the stats. Do share them. What have you managed to deliver? Unfortunately, you're not in charge of the COVID delivery that I'm aware of, are you?
No, indeed.
So, as someone who stood in a very long queue and didn't get vaxxed. Anyway,
So what robotic process automation does in the first instance, perhaps, is it in the event where we have data housed in different databases or different IT systems, robotics can be a very efficient way of transferring that data from one system to another. And we've done work across a number of government departments and agencies where we have seen the very practical benefit of not having people rekey that information, but actually have robots rekey it. And instead of it taking, for example, 45 minutes, as in one use case that we had, it takes maybe 2.5 minutes. And instead of the robotics needing to stop for lunch and wanting to go home to go to sleep, it'll run all night and 24/7. So therefore creating real efficiency and ultimately creating the capacity to have that very valuable and scarce commodity, people's time, go back into the system to do higher value activities.
So do share with me about some case studies, because they are really, really interesting.
So some very practical ones. Garda vetting is a very practical one where we have worked with the HSE in automating the Garda vetting process. That was two people full time that were doing maybe 40 or 50 Garda vetting applications a day. And that has been significantly enhanced. The two people are now available to do other work. And the robot, Bertie, is going to the process.
Does he have a name?
Bertie.
I did read recently that part of the process is to give these robots names. It is just a fact of life that we like knowing it's not just a machine. We give them kind of a personality.
Well, we do. We give them a personality because we talk about their work and their performance and how we can help improve them. We talk to them about their personal development plans.
But you didn't name Bertie after any particular Taoiseach or anything, no?
No.
So what does Bertie do that the two used to do? The two are doing 50 a day and now Bertie can do? I mean, are we into hundreds or thousands?
Hundreds. I mean, in the 45 minutes, Bertie's now taking 2.5 minutes.
Wow.
So you start to multiply that out.
You've done your applied maths. You can do it to 20 times. Yeah. Okay. We'll call it 20
Lots.
Times more.
Yeah.
Lots. Exactly. Any other ones that you are applying?
Yeah. I mean, we have provided them a number across the HSC to the guards themselves, to Pobble, the Department of Education. Again, a very practical one. Perhaps in the health service, in their finance business, where they were collecting financial information from 8 different public authorities within the HSC. And that was a monthly process. Again, that took a couple of hours every month. It's financial reconciliation. So you're into people opening up spreadsheets and, of course, the risks that can happen when people are moving data across spreadsheets. So by automating that process, not only has it removed the need for humans to do it, but it's actually moved the process to being daily instead of monthly. Also, because it's so rules-based, the likelihood of it making a mistake, i.e. copying data from one cell into the wrong cell or from the wrong cell into the wrong cell, is almost eliminated. So you have the quality benefit, you have the timeless benefit, and of course then you have the impact of the return of those individuals back into the workforce to do something that's of greater value.
And I know when you're sitting in your bath, you think of the future and the future of robotics. Where do you think this will bring us, say, 5 years' time within government? Where will we see it in terms of the public sector?
I think there are some really, really practical applications. And so the robotics that we are working with at the moment is centered very much on the fact that the data is already well-structured and in a database. That database might simply be an Excel spreadsheet, but it's well-structured data. So on the data entry, from the data entry side, the opportunity is to look at data that comes in on paper forms, that's, for example, OCR'd, scanned in, and then the scanned record, perhaps that somebody has filled in by pen, is being automatically uploaded into the database, and that information is then being enriched through the robotics and processed. At the other end, I think the opportunity is for the workflow that the robotics, that the RPA bots are running, that workflow becomes much more intelligent and starts to deal with the edge cases or the exceptions. So at the moment, what would happen is if the data doesn't quite fit or there's an error in the process that something has gone wrong, it would notify a human. As the process becomes more intelligent, as the data is richer, it would find ways then to deal with those exceptions and not need to contact a human. And as that starts to happen, and as I say, as the data set gets richer, as data sets get richer, you start to get greater insights from the processes, which then gives you the data to say, actually, do we need this process in the first place? How really are we, you know, how really are we set up in the running of this particular operation?
And how long, you are the preferred supplier to government, how long is that contract running for or until, or does it have to go out again? Like, is it
will have, it will have to go back out again exactly for retender. So we've been on the framework for 2 years. And typically with these contracts, they will have a fixed period and a series of variable periods, and it'll be up to the government to decide how they'd like to continue with that framework in the future.
Here's a little hint for you. Change the name of the bot to Michal. Might be a good idea. You might get some extra brandy points. Do you know what I'm going to do, Harry? I'm going to take a quick break because we, like you, have to pay the bills. So we'll be back right after this.
Viscosity. When you shave, you want the highest viscosity because it helps the blade run smoother. DeFacto, the world's best shaving oil, has incredible viscosity. That's why DeFacto leaves your face, underarms or legs nick-free. Higher viscosity makes blades last longer. DeFacto is the best for your skin and your pocket. DeFactoShave.com.
Everyday accounting can be a bit of a drama for SMEs. However, BigRedCloud.com takes the drama away with its simple and easy-to-use cloud-based accounting and payroll software designed for SME owners. Raise and send invoices, manage VAT reports and obligations, run management reports, link directly to Irish banks, automatically import purchase invoices, and so much more. All with five-star customer support. BigRedCloud.com, 100% Irish-owned and a proud member of Team GBS.
Canobio at That Great Business Show.
So I am here with Harry Goddard on this special edition of That Great Business Show. Harry is the CEO of Deloitte. CEO, you're not managing partner.
When we made the transition to become much more integrated with the Deloitte member firms and other geographies, a feature of that transition is that the person who leads the firm in the country is a CEO, and the person who leads the combined geographies is the managing partner. In reality, we use both terms somewhat interchangeably, but formally, that's the distinction.
And have you a shelf life? That's a nice word, isn't it?
I certainly do. I have a number of shelf lives.
Well, as CEO, how long more do you get? You went in at 2019. So
I went in 1st of June 2019, and my first term is a four-year term. And I have the option of up to 2 4-year terms.
Okay.
So and about 18 months to go to...
Go and tell them. Are you going to do it? Are you going to go again?
Absolutely. I mean, the key thing for me would be the support, obviously, of the partners in the firm. But if I have the support of the partners in the firm, I would love to do it. It's a great job. I thoroughly enjoy it. It's a great business. It's a fantastic role in which to make a real impact, both internally in the organization, but also out into the marketplace and in our community.
Beyond your robots, what else are you doing on that side of the business that I love these kind of wow? Just where are you seeing really big, significant changes in how people are doing business?
Cloud. The transition to cloud is extraordinary. And we run a program called the Best Managed Companies, where we look at Irish Indigenous businesses and their performance and the performance of the management teams. And there is an award process that sits beside that. And I remember...
That'd be very like the EY one as well, would it be?
Which is focused on the entrepreneur, whereas we like to think that it's...
So you also have your Fast 50, of course, don't you?
Indeed.
Yeah. Marketing would be very pleased with me now.
Thank you. The thing that struck me is about 3 years ago, of the businesses that we are assessing who are applying to the Best Managed Companies, I remember one or two that had transitioned their business model to being cloud-based. So instead of investing lots of capital, charging their clients for the upfront capital and then for the services, they were running their business off the operational costs instead. Roll forward a couple of years, the majority of the firms that were applying that were in that, particularly the technology and telecommunication sector, had made that shift. The shift to cloud has been phenomenal. And we've all seen it. I think as we all returned, as we all dealt with the pandemic and moved to work from home, whether it was Teams, Zoom, Google Hangout, we were all suddenly connected to the cloud and using that as the core platform for access to our information and services.
And just to grow and grow and grow, will it?
Certainly, the potential for it to grow is extraordinarily significant, and there are a couple of elements to it. So there is the infrastructure element, which is that instead of having a large data center, I now have access to all of the computing power that I require in somebody else's data center, but not in my own. And therefore, the cost of administration and management is quite different, and also the cost to run it is quite different. The second part, which is, I think, much more interesting, is the services that are available on the cloud. So for organizations that choose to use, whether it's Google's cloud or Microsoft's cloud or whichever vendor's cloud, those vendors typically provide a whole suite of services that are available to apply to the data that's held in the cloud. They could be services around artificial intelligence, for example, analytics, cognitive engines. So really sophisticated capability that's available in what is in effect your own data center without you having had to invest in the development of them.
Cognitive intelligence, is that what you said?
Cognitive and artificial intelligence.
What is cognitive intelligence? I don't think I've come across that term.
So cognitive is when, as artificial intelligence as the umbrella, and within artificial intelligence is cognitive capability, where the machine will actually learn from the data that it is assessing and analysing, and will ultimately continue to develop its own algorithms to become increasingly efficient.
They're going to take over, aren't they?
It's worth rewatching the Terminator movie because the premise behind that is one that would feel quite real today.
It is happening. It doesn't worry you.
I think it does. When you think about the handbrake to artificial intelligence in particular, the handbrake is that there's a big red switch somewhere. And the difficulty with the big red switch is that is connected to the very computer you're trying to switch off, which will presumably realize you are indeed trying to switch it off.
And kill you before you get to the switch.
May not be best pleased with that as a strategy. So,
Genuinely, does it keep you awake at night at all, just thinking, maybe this isn't such a good idea? In some areas, not obviously, some of it is fantastic.
I think the thing that probably would keep me awake is the ethics of artificial intelligence. And I think there's so much that we don't yet understand. And if you stand back and you look at mobile phones, let's just say over the last 10 or 15 years, we had these phones. They were absolutely fantastic. The flexibility, you could get your email on your phone. You could contact people so easily. It was just magnificent. And over time, we realized the consequences of that always-on capability. We realized the societal impacts of people being able to share whatever they thought, whenever they felt like it. And you saw then the consequences potentially of, for example, of cyberbullying. I don't know that we have really thought through all of the consequences of artificial intelligence. And I don't think that we are set up in a way to really guard ourselves against the ethical consequences of artificial intelligence writ large in our environment. Now, I think there's enormous power in artificial intelligence, and there are very significant benefits that can be accrued through it. But I suppose it's all about whose hand is on the steering wheel of that power.
And if I were to go to a well-known consultant, what would the well-known consultant tell me as to how can we rein it in, rein it back, or just make sure that it doesn't take over?
I think the consultant is probably dealing with the business who's trying to work out how best to use this technology in their organization. And I would regard that as a fairly controlled environment. Mm-hmm. I think where it becomes more difficult to control is when artificial intelligence is embedded into key products and technologies that are being used by whole societies. And that's where it gets a lot trickier.
I thought everybody wanted an intelligent fridge, so it would tell you to buy new lettuce when the lettuce has gone stale or old or awful.
Indeed, and I think there are use cases like that. The difficulty is that it might start then to recommend all sorts of other things you might require. And in fact, you find these things arriving at your front door before you knew you needed them.
And don't go near the booze again. It's useful, actually, to talk about the staff and staff issues, because you, as in Harry Goddard, I think you've been pretty much out there trying to change culture internally within Deloitte and making it very inclusive. Would I be right, or have I been spun a story?
I think it's hugely important to us, and from a couple of perspectives. I think one of the things that distinguishes Ireland on the world stage is our inclusive culture. We are an open economy. We welcome everybody. We create the opportunity for people to live and work here. We crack the glass on marriage equality. We continue to encourage and facilitate people to come here and work. I think it's hugely important as a distinctive capability on our island. And if I look in our business, I think it is really important that our business inside reflects the society in which we operate. And if I make that really, really practical and straightforward, if we go to a client and the senior execs and the client are female, we better be going in with a largely female team.
And how many partners have you, women partners have you got?
26% of our partners are female. So that's about 27 people.
Okay. And when you move down management into, what's the next layer?
Directors, senior managers. So as we If I look at our overall organisation, we're about 4951.
Are you? That's well done. And, okay, congratulations on that.
But that doesn't happen. That is a lot of work. So, for example, very practical things. When we look at our processes internally, we are looking to get 50-50 from a gender point of view to ensure that we have equal participation in our advancements and development programmes. And when we're hiring out in the marketplace, we are incentivizing recruiters to ensure that they give us balance in the portfolio of candidates that they give to us.
Well, I presume reversing that, I mean, surely at this stage, recruiters know that there has to be balance.
I think they know that, but yeah. Making it real is the thing. And the thing that strikes me most about inclusivity and even gender equity across the organization is what people know instinctively and how they behave and react isn't necessarily the same thing, because we have been operating in businesses according to a certain pattern, a set of processes that are so embedded in the organization and have been there for so long that we're actually capable as humans to behave that way and then talk in a completely different way. And it's not out of any intention or malintent or anything like that. That's just what happens. And I have experienced that firsthand when I talk to leaders about the actions that they should take to facilitate inclusive behaviour and the things that they're actually doing and trying just
and
to
I presume what they're doing is not good, as in it's not 100%.
Yeah, and I wouldn't be pejorative using words that are not good or you know, bad or good. I would just say that what they're doing isn't going to change the outcomes that they're experiencing. And if ultimately they want to change the outcomes that they're experiencing, they're going to have to make changes internally.
So what do you do within Deloitte to achieve those goals?
So from a gender point of view, we have our gender strategy in place. And as I mentioned, a couple of things that we do, which again are very practical.
When you're hiring, are you going 50-50? If there are 100 people coming into you, 50 have to be women?
So if we're hiring from the graduate pool, which is our largest pool, it has to be 50-50.
How many do you hire a year?
About 300.
Okay.
And as we go up the ranks, we sustain that pretty well. The challenge that we experience, Conal, is that people join us in equal 50-50. They probably leave us in 50-50. The real challenge we have is the experienced hire marketplace and trying to get the experienced hires to join us on a 50-50 basis. And we see it in our own. What we see is that men are more mobile and females are less mobile. So attracting particularly more senior.
What's that about?
There are a whole range of reasons that sit behind that potentially. One of the things we're super focused on is really understanding how we can create an environment that is far more attractive to that experienced female talent.
Such as, what are you doing?
So very practical things, incentivizing our recruiters, ensuring that we have, again, practically speaking, family-friendly and female-friendly policies and work, equalizing the amount.
So just on those, what are they? What would, you know, practically, what are they?
So, a couple of things, providing parental leave to fathers in the same amount as we provide to mothers. And not just providing the leave, but also trying to encourage men to take it. Normalizing the fact that people will take time out of their career for a number of months is incredibly important, that it doesn't have an effect in any way on their progression.
Is that only, not only available to, but is that a perk, if I can call it a perk, that only a large organization can give? I'm thinking of, you know, the millions of little SMEs. There's no way that SMEs can just say, go off there for a few months and come back to me.
So I think there's two things. I think there is equity. So are we providing equal opportunities to men and women? And then are the supports that are in place appropriate to all? And I would separate those two things out. Because there are lots of businesses that can provide, lots of SME businesses that can provide flexible working and part-time working to men and women, and provided that they do that in a way that's equal to all and that it provides those individuals with equivalent opportunity, then I think that's okay.
Sorry, I interrupted you because you were going to talk to me some more about some of the initiatives.
So some of the other very practical things are providing support to females for example, menopause, if there is loss during pregnancy. So again, very practical things just to ensure that our people know.
And where did you come up with those ideas? Are they internationally throughout Deloitte, or was Harry sitting there talking to his team?
I'd say it's a combination of things. I mean, clearly we look at best practice around the world, but I think the most important thing is just to listen to your people. And it's incredible when you give people a platform, they'll tell you exactly what's frustrating them and what is creating obstacles for them.
Now, go back to the partner meetings. If you are trying to listen to your teams and you have 3,000 people now, I presume that they cannot all get 5 minutes of your time because Harry has to do some work as well. Where would the forum be and what would the forum look like where those chats are had?
A couple of places. We have our various networks. So we have our Gender Balance Network, for example, who would discuss the things that are either accelerating or preventing gender equity across the organization. We would have equivalent versions for our multicultural network and for our LGBTQ and for our disability access programs. In addition, we have provided what's called, and we do this because it's a function of the scale of the organization. When you talk about a conversation that you'd like to have between two people and both parties are in the room, that's one thing. When you try to roll it out to 3,000 people, it starts to get a bit more complicated. So one of the very practical things we've rolled out is what's called an inclusion passport. And what the inclusion passport does is it allows somebody, so I could, for example, capture my inclusion passport, for example, that I have dyslexia. And actually, every now and again, every couple of hours, I need a bit of space for myself. And I work best when I got headphones on because it allows me to concentrate, because there are things that are particular to me. Now, it could be whatever is appropriate to the individual for their particular requirements. And that inclusion passport is something that's understood. It travels around with me on our internal performance management systems. So when I sit down and I join a team, as part of joining that team, I share my inclusion passport with my team leader so that I'm not having to start the conversation at the very beginning and sort of embarrassingly introduce these things that are constraints to how I want to be able to work. And as I say, that could be anything. It could be the hours that I can work. It could be the requirements that I need to accommodate my personal life. It might even be as simple as the fact that I need to go training two nights a week. But whatever the requirements are that I need to be successful in my role are captured in that inclusion passport and used to help me make my way through the organization.
And you, with your 20 years of management consultancy experience and all of that area, plus your applied maths, you can tell me that you've done the maths on this. And does it add up to eventually greater productivity, greater efficiency? Where is the benefit for Deloitte from being so nice?
I think at a couple of places. First of all, in my experience, people reward loyalty from the business with their own loyalty, and they are always prepared to go that extra mile to serve our clients and to support the business in achieving its objectives once it knows that the organization has its back and is listening.
Do you have a higher or lower turnover of staff than others who don't have those employment perks built into their contracts?
I would say, well, I mean, at the moment, I know attrition levels are running at an unusual...
The great resignation.
Is ongoing. So
and
maybe
is it, you're actually seeing that, are you?
For sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that's manifesting for all sorts of reasons. It's quite difficult to unpick that, but I look at the data associated with that every month to try to understand what's happening in the marketplace. What I would say is, just to your question... not having those things is just not acceptable in our environment. Having
okay,
those things
is a good answer. I understand it. Yeah. And where it sounds like the kind of thing that will become the absolute norm across all organizations, small, teeny, or huge.
I think so. Ultimately, I mean, I think there's a couple of things happening. I think first of all, how we think about a workforce is incredibly important, and. The workforce isn't just there to work. The workforce, of course, is there to work, but wants to understand that the organization is going to provide support to them. And that's a very personal and individual thing. And in larger organizations, that's more difficult because you're trying to scale bespoke, which is really hard to do. But also, I think that the workforce is much more concerned with the, how does this business think about equity? Equality? How does it think about social inclusion? How does it think about the climate? And being able to facilitate that discussion in a constructive way, which means not just listening, but being able to respond, I think is going to be important for every business.
I keep reading that to hire young people at the moment, you're not going to get them unless you show these credentials. Are you seeing that like naked or raw, or is that just the kind of, it sounds good, looks good, oh, but, you know, they'll just go to the highest bidder?
I'll take you back, Conal, if you can remember the days pre-pandemic when we actually could meet people in rooms. Mm-hmm. And we had a recruitment event for graduates coming into the firm. And I think, I can't quite remember the numbers, but let's just say there was maybe 300 people in a room who had successfully applied to Deloitte and were going to have an interview the following day. So this was an orientation session that they were doing in our offices. And so I meet them for Q&A. And they want to know what my point of view on the climate crisis is. They don't want to know, tell me about the initiatives Deloitte are undertaking about waste management, water management and recycling. They want to know, Harry Goddard, what kind of car do you drive? Do you have a brown bin at home and do you do that sort of recycling?
Will you ask those questions?
Absolutely. Okay. They want to know my personal philosophy. So it's not just that people who are joining the organization are interested that the firm, that the organization has an agenda that they buy into. They want to know that the leaders have an agenda that they buy into.
Good God, I'd never survive in there if they asked me about my personal philosophy. Listen, Harry, we better take a quick break and I'll be back after this short break.
Make one small switch. Switching from shaving foam to all-natural de facto shaving oil will give you the smoothest, softest shave ever. Switching from shaving oil to de facto helps stop 20 million non-recyclable shaving foam cans go to landfills every year. Switching from shaving oil to de facto will save your skin, your pocket, and your planet. DeFactoShave.com.
Everyday accounting can be a bit of a drama for SMEs. However, BigRentCloud.com takes the drama away with its simple and easy to use cloud-based accounting and payroll software designed for SME owners. Raise and send invoices, manage VAT reports and obligations, run management reports, link directly to Irish banks, automatically import purchase invoices and so much more. All with 5-star customer support. BigRentCloud.com, 100% Irish owned and a proud member of Team GBS.
It's all go, let Coursey know on thatgreatbusinessshow.com.
And I'm here with Harry Goddard, who is CEO of Deloitte, and we are talking all things robotic and hiring and the great resignation. And now, Harry, I'd like you to fix Ireland Inc., please. You have a vast amount of experience. You are leading 3,000 people, one of the larger organizations in the country. You have taken a very, very active interest, because I've been told so, in politics, economics, and matters state. How would you fix, let's start, the housing crisis by Harry Goddard?
I would not rush into a series of solutions for the housing crisis. I think there are two things that are interlinked, which are really important. Transport infrastructure and housing. And our housing crisis is made worse by our transport infrastructure. Because if you want to live and be close to the city where the economic activity is happening, you need to live close to, you need to live there, because it's very difficult to get in and out. So I think there are two very practical points that are interrelated.
One of them is the big issue is planning. And it doesn't matter whether it's for infrastructure or whether it's for housing. We Irish, fantastic people that we are, do not want to allow people to build houses or bigger roads or smaller roads or better, whatever.
You know, of course we don't want anything happening in our environment. We never do. But actually, the thing I would observe that we find really difficult to do is that when we decide to do something, we often step over two key steps. We don't do a great job in designing that which we ultimately want, and we don't always do a great job in how we plan it. And as a result, we find ourselves in the middle of these projects that are incredibly difficult, that are taking too long, that feel much harder than we thought they were going to be, and aren't meeting the financial commitments that we had set around them. And that sets our mood and sets our tone as we think about any future infrastructure or housing investments. So there are some capability gaps, I would suggest, in how we think about some of these very, very large projects. And I would balance with that the people that we're dealing with who undertake these projects are international and they're huge. They have real strength and depth and scale. And for us to really be match fit in how we manage them and work with them, we've got to build that capability ourselves.
Are you suggesting that large organizations, international organizations that might be involved in development, might be taking the state or the taxpayer for a ride?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think that they're probably doing precisely what they're asked. But they have a better sense of the consequences ultimately, and are working to the process that's being run by the state. And the state potentially doesn't have all of the resources on its side to support it in both the negotiation and then navigation of the contract. Because these contracts regularly require some sort of replanning once the plan has made contact with the enemy, whether that's the hole in the ground or the snails that live in the hole in the ground.
You're not answering that, how you're going to fix the housing problem. I'm not expecting it really, because it's almost impossible. But if you want your staff, and maybe one day they'll be allowed back into the office, to live near the office, you've got to find some which way that they can live there. What are you going to do?
When the pandemic struck in March, in the June or July after that March, I did a series of calls with people who joined our firm in the first 3 months, just to get their point of view on what they thought about the pandemic.
These are brand newbies straight into Deloitte, yeah?
Some of them had been in Deloitte for up to 2 years, say, but so their first couple of years out of college. And the two points of view that they had was, number one, they were no longer competing with their friends and neighbours up and down the road or from UCD or wherever. They were now competing for jobs with people from all over the world.
Okay.
The second observation they had was that they could now afford to buy a house. That they were no longer tied to having to live in Dublin.
Okay.
And we have seen 35% of our population since the pandemic has moved address.
Of, when you say your population, the Deloitte workforce? And yes. Did you track their move? Was it outside the pale?
Generally speaking, it's down the country. So
it must be great to have a couple of 100 acres down in Newmarket on Fergus, is it?
Well, they weren't mine, but it would be.
If it had road frontage, of course.
Yes, indeed.
So, okay, that's a fundamental change. So
it's a massive change, and that's why I think transport infrastructure is so important.
Do you remember that we were trying to decentralise the country
public
once upon a time? Yeah?
That's right, yeah.
Maybe that's about to happen or is happening.
I mean, I think it is happening or happened. You know, the extent to which we are now comfortable not having to all be, you know, within 5 square kilometres of each other, that we're able to do business successfully, that we can connect, I think is a huge differentiator. We spent, and it goes to how we think about our offices, you know, we spent 20 or 30 years learning how to use offices, learning how to do business in a city centre. And we now find ourselves in an environment where the things that we thought were rules actually aren't rules anymore. And we're in this transitionary period where we're trying to figure out, well, what do we think the rules might be in the future? And
do any of your staff in Dublin or in Ireland live outside of Ireland?
For tax reasons, it's very difficult for us to facilitate that.
So that's a no, is it? You didn't say a no.
No. We do have, and I can't remember the percentage off the top of my head, we do have a percentage of people who have moved back home for various reasons, for sure. But for tax reasons, we're trying hard to manage that.
What's the issue?
The issue is that they're not resident, and that ultimately has an impact on their tax status and ultimately then potentially on the business as well.
And would they have to come, actually it's the reverse of what normally happens here, would they have to come here for a few days, a week or something, to make themselves tax resident?
And again, I'm not a tax professional, so...
We're not going there. We're
definitely not. Definitely yeah. Not going there. So we need them ultimately to come back to be based in Ireland.
Regularly. This is my little dream. I'd love to sit on a beach in Portugal working for somebody or something like that. That would be a rather nice way of living. But it's not happening. No.
Not happening.
No, okay.
Not happening. Not happening. And very few businesses, very, very few businesses are facilitating that. It is incredibly expensive and it's complex. Very complex.
So you've solved the housing problems. What about the health problems?
I mean, the health sector has warranted a significant investment in particularly technology, but also resources and process capability for a number of years. I think that's writ large now and has been exposed through the pandemic. And if you weren't sure about it then I think the cyber attack made you definitely sure. So there is a very significant investment that will be required in due course into the health system.
And I know that this is not your area of expertise either, but are we talking about, just in technology, are we talking about hundreds of millions or are we into billions?
I would say we're so far into the hundreds of millions, we're close to the billions. It is really significant.
But it's absolutely necessary.
It's absolutely necessary. I mean, I think for us, the question ultimately is going to be, you know, what do we determine as the landing spot?
What do you mean by that?
So you could look at a health system, like a private health system, a private integrated health system in the US, for example, Kaiser Permanente, who are a private healthcare system that would provide almost the equivalent range of services that the HSE provide. So hospitals right through to GPs and tertiary care. And in fact, Kaiser has its own platform, technology platform that's fully integrated. And if you're a customer of Kaiser's, it deals with your health insurance and then access to all of your services. So if we feel that's the landing spot that we want, that's very expensive. And then you are very, very high, hundreds of millions. You're into really big numbers.
But would Kaiser come over and sell their platform, do you think? Wouldn't that be a simple solution? Or am I being too simplistic?
So I think there are healthcare providers like Kaiser and others who would make their platform available. But the platform isn't just the technology; it's also the processes, and then also the organizational capability. There's no fast way of doing this. This, however we go about this, is going to take a long time. I think it's going to be expensive and hard.
I'm afraid. I'm getting very sad again. So, how are you going to fix the economy? We owe 220 billion, and let's say we throw another couple of billion at the HSE. So, where are we going to get that, and how are we going to keep alive in the say next 5 years?
The critical thing for all, there are two things I think really important for Ireland Inc. And I remember I met with he's a member of the tax working group for the OECD on behalf of the US, and was at the time he was Obama's global tax advisor. And I put it to him, you know, Ireland, sure, it's all tax and talent, isn't it? And he said, I'm not so sure about the tax so much. It's really your differentiator around talent is significant. And at the time, Brexit was unfolding. Talent is hugely important to the future of the economy. And it's not just that the talent that we generate in Ireland, which is incredibly important, but facilitating talent coming to Ireland is also really important. The proposition that they have when they come here is hugely important. And that, of course, brings you back to the housing.
I was going to say, we have no houses for these people. Of course, we'd love to have them.
And it's a very practical issue. Because if you say to a senior executive that they and their family and perhaps their kids, for example, are to move to Ireland and set themselves up, you need them to be able to get a house that's close to a good school and get access to the education system. These are really important.
The same thing that everybody else wants as well, of course.
Of course, yeah, the same thing that everybody else wants.
Yeah.
But when you go to how is Ireland retain its position in the global economy, you get down to a small number of businesses and a small number of people in those businesses, and it gets very practical very fast. So sustaining that talent, I think, is enormously important. Our influence in the EU and our relationship with the EU is going to be hugely important, and equally, obviously, with the UK. And the US-Ireland-EU trade corridor, that we continue to remain focused on that. The Americans continue to look very positively on Ireland, notwithstanding how they might look at outside of the US over the next number of years. There's certainly room for that to continue to evolve. But we have big businesses that are firmly established here. There is the potential, you know, if you look over the next couple of years, particularly in a US-China context, there is the potential that supply lines could shorten. Would that create opportunity for Ireland? My own sense is that if I'm a US business, I'm looking at Europe, Africa, and the Middle East as a portfolio.
Kind of cutting out China.
I think how the US engages with China is not going to be how it is not going to be economically embracing in the way they might have been thinking about it up to the last, you know, up to maybe a couple of years ago. I think it's difficult to see them coming closer together. I think that's going to become an increasingly problematic relationship. And if I'm a US business, I've got big markets in Africa and big markets in the Middle East, and I've got a base in Europe, which is Ireland. And I think for Ireland, it's about how do you ensure that remains the hub of their operations into those geographies.
And one of those issues will be the rising corporate tax rate. Do you think, is it significant? Will the people move for that or
no?
Or maybe not move?
No, I don't think so. And to be fair, I think even talking to clients prior to the change, They were, I mean, I wouldn't describe them as benign, would be unfair, but to say that they were sort of balanced in their views, if it's going to happen, just let it happen. You had some organizations, to be honest with you, for organizations that felt it was really problematic, they have a different business model question they've got to try to answer. For the majority of organizations that are invested in Ireland, my sense is that they, at that time, they were very, very balanced about it, and since then have continued to be balanced about it. I don't see any.
Okay, let's throw out the final one, Brexit. Discuss. Because every day you just think, those guys are just barmy.
It's, I think it's incredible. And, you know, if anybody can ever work out what the top of the UK government really wants, before they actually articulate it, I think that they're warranted a prize of some sort. It is incredibly difficult to navigate through. And
what's your sense? Will we just divest ourselves of trading with Britain in a big way? I see it happening already in my own home, where I see kids not buying stuff out of the UK because too much hassle, too much VAT, too much taxes.
Too hard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you look at the history of trading all over the world, proximity counts and language counts. And I think ultimately, you know, we will find a way to facilitate better trading between the UK and Ireland in particular. The Northern Ireland Protocol facilitates that to a certain extent, but that's too complex. And I think the irony of the UK government, using Article 16, is in fact that they are signing up, they are confirming that they are signed up to the Brexit agreement, because they are invoking a clause in it, and it's going to be about hopefully getting some sensible heads to negotiate something that's pragmatic to facilitate ongoing trade.
Does Deloitte advise the UK government? Do you have any insights from that side? What are they advising the UK government on?
I don't think I found anybody who's prepared to admit that they're advising the UK government on Brexit.
Oh, you betcha. Yeah, so weird. One of the final questions we ask, and I say one of because I always find other ones that I want to ask about, hire in a heartbeat. I hope I saw you saw this in the email, is that I was going to ask you about who would Harry Goddard hire in a heartbeat?
I didn't know you were going to ask me that.
A lot of people seem to miss this on their emails.
Yeah.
But anyway, but what I'm looking for always, and if you mention Richard Branson, you're going out the door, because everybody says Richard Branson.
No, I wouldn't hurt
somebody
him.
Somebody that you would say, God, I'd love to have that person on my team. Why would you not hire Richard Branson as a man of interest?
I wouldn't hire Richard Branson. I think Richard's done some very impressive, incredible things. And
okay, yeah. That was very diplomatic. Yeah. So who would you hire?
Who would I hire?
You can hire a few people.
Yeah.
Somebody suggested Mother Teresa, but it did suggest that she was
not particularly economic.
Exactly.
Who would I like to have around me to influence my thinking and how we grow the business? If I was to answer the question that way, I think Mark Zuckerberg, lots of reasons why you mightn't like him. I just think that has just a phenomenal perspective and worldview on how technology is going to influence the economy.
Which came first, him or his worldview? I'm asking that question, obviously. Maybe you've met him. Have you ever met him?
No.
Okay. Just wondering, is he just got a magnificently huge brain? Or, as happens, did he get lucky and he has the space maybe to think about the world and about the future?
I mean, I don't think he's got the space. I mean, this is a guy who still cuts code, right? I mean, it's I don't know what his daily lifestyle is like, but I suspect it's pretty intense. I mean, the way I'd answer that, Conal, is I remember 9 months ago somebody explaining the metaverse to me, and I think to myself, oh my God, he really has lost the run of himself now.
Right? Did you billions, figure out, did somebody explain it to you successfully?
Billions being invested in it. They attempted to. Billions being invested in it. Bill Gates last week said within 2 years, many companies will be meeting in the metaverse. And I do regard Bill Gates as a fairly serious kind of a guy who's not prone to, you know, reacting, or he is a very considerate individual. And that really struck me. So I think the guy definitely has a worldview. I think he is quite visionary. and his capacity to do that and stay connected to young people and really understand how they think about the world, I think is exceptional.
And you know why he knows all of that? Because he has their insight and insights from all their phones and everything else. So of course, he's, you know, what's he connected to? 3 billion, 4 billion, or something?
Something incredible. Yeah. But if you want to look at the future, talk to young people. And
There's a perfect segue, because your marketing people will kill you, not me, if you don't put out a call as to why, because I know how incredibly difficult it is to recruit at the moment. If you don't put out a call to say why young people should apply to Deloitte.
I think the opportunity in Deloitte is for people to make their impact in the world through their career. We invest heavily in their own personal development. We encourage them through very practical things, for example, the Deloitte People Fund, to be able to invest in charitable causes that are important to them. We think it's incredibly important that they identify, articulate, and invest in that sense of purpose that they have of themselves, and that they do it through our organization.
How many people are you hiring per year? You said 300. Are you
300 graduates.
And are you still out with your net trying to
We're still out with our net, yeah. We announced a couple of months ago that we were looking for an additional 300 experienced hires. So that's about 600 people in
a year.
Where
are they all going to go? I suppose down to Clare.
Well, I think that's the thing. Exactly. So rethinking the use of the office. And that has been quite a journey.
See, now you've set me off again. At some stage, presumably, there will be an awful lot of office space for sale or leases not being renewed.
I think the way we think about the office is changing fundamentally, and I don't think that we're at the end of understanding that change yet. And we used to understand it quite clearly in how we would use the office. We would take the number of people that we had, we'd say that percentage of them will be around. Surely they need a few meeting rooms and we might want to train them. And now the way we think about it is we want client collaboration spaces, we want training facilities, and we might need a few desks for people. And
do you hot desk?
Oh, yeah.
Does Harry Goddard hot desk?
Yeah, I've been hot desking since the pandemic.
Could I be sitting at Harry Goddard's desk one day and Harry comes in and says, that's my desk, get out of there?
Unlikely, because we have a desk booking system, but you could be sitting beside Harry Goddard's desk.
Okay. The future and how to avoid it. Harry Goddard, that was really, really interesting. Thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business Show. And that is it from That Great Business Show, episode 68. My thanks to all the team here at the Dublin Podcast Studios. Most importantly, today's sound engineer, Peter Rice, who every week makes sure we are the world's best sounding podcast. Do please share this podcast with anyone who loves business. And also do subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast platform. That makes sure that Ireland's best business podcast is always close by. And we are here to help businesses like yours. So if there are issues or topics you would like us to cover, contact us using our favorite LinkedIn page, where we have our dedicated page where you can chat directly with us. How exciting. And if you're planning an ad campaign, we'd love to help. Join companies like Big Red Cloud, organizations like ISME and Uderos de Goethe, who recognize it's a great way to talk to Ireland's SMEs. Contact us at greatbusinessshow.com. And as always, the great business insights you hear on That Great Business Show are only made possible thanks to our sponsor, the great makers of the world's best shaving oil, De Facto, made in Mayo, sold worldwide. All right, thanks to them. So from me, Conal O'Moran, until the next time, Slán tamall.